tone. Everyone can tell what it is, but how do you get it? With so many styles of music, with new gear coming out almost daily, what's the secret to great tone? Welcome to the Flow Guitar Enthusiast Radio Show, where we talk about tone, what it is, and how to get it. With your hosts, Jeff Floro and Scott Sill, we will talk to the creators of tone, the manufacturers, and the players as we explore tone and the gear that gets it. And now, here are your hosts, Jeff Floro and Scott Sill.
The Flow Guitar Enthusiast is proudly sponsored by Celestion Speakers. Make sure to check out the new Celestion Creamback H. It provides a tighter low end and a much more pronounced high end than the standard Creamback. Welcome to the Flow Guitar Enthusiast. Welcome, Jeff.
Hey, welcome, Scott. It's a great night tonight. We're going to have some fun tonight.
Yeah, this is going to be fantastic. We've got an amp as big as it gets coming in here, but yet still low powered. We'll talk about that here in a second.
Yes, just pure tone at a lower volume.
What's been going on with you? What have you been up to?
Oh, a bunch of different things. I've been doing some mods on some of my guitars. I'll be talking about that in a little bit, but I've been going through some of the older guitars that I have, and one of the ones I pulled out is a Guild 12 string that I actually looked up in the Guild book, and it might have been the first year that it was made.
Very cool.
Very cool, like 66.
Nice.
So that should be a really nice.
What are you about? What were you about 40 then? Kidding.
Okay, Scott. Yes.
Sorry, man. Well, I just want to let everyone know. So I put out a video of Jason Sine playing four different vintage instruments. Ridiculously clean, beautiful instruments. They all played wonderful. You should check it out on YouTube, on my YouTube channel Selenium, and check that out. Also, I want to let everyone know that in 2 weeks, on August 26th, we have, who I'm quite excited about, the legend, Billy Sheehan, coming on
yes.
the show. So he'll be coming on, and we'll be giving away a Hartke Bass Attack pedal on that show. So make sure you go to our website, www.flowguitarenthusiast.com, and sign up to win that pedal. And maybe we'll get him to sign it if we can.
Yeah, and Billy's one of the guys, he does amazing things with just four strings.
Just that's all he needs.
That's all he needs.
Why does he need anything else? So definitely take a listen to that show. That'll be a fantastic show. And while you're at our website, go and join us on our live chat room on www.flowguitarenthusiast.com.
Yes.
And later in the show, if you want, you can give a call and call 323-203-0815, 323-203-0815, to ask our guest any question. And speaking of our guest today,
yes.
we have Dan Buhl, president of 65 Amps. Welcome, Dan.
Hey, guys. Thank you for having me.
Thank you.
It's a pleasure.
This is my first time on internet radio, and I'm loving it.
Well, it's quite fun, I must say. You can say whatever you want here. We're not ruled by FCC, but you know,
really,
we do try to keep it kid or you know kid and family.
We do have
family
some younger. Friendly. We have younger listeners.
That'll be very hard for me, but I'll try.
Well, no, if you let
I have
one
little
slip.
Kids too, so it's
yeah.
cool.
Well, just to start off, can you tell us about you're a heck of a guitar player. How did you come about making amps?
Well, it's just sort of my nature. The very first amp that I got of any substance, I got a Marshall when I was 13, I guess, eighth grade, and I went and took it apart and learned how it worked, and my dad was furious with me. And I had to learn how to put it back together. It's my nature. I'm always curious how things work and why things are better. So my business partner and I, Peter Stroud, have kind of been amp nerds together since the late 80s. And I got the hiccups. I'm sorry. And there was a period a little over 10 years ago. Peter now plays for Sheryl Crow. And Sheryl was demanding that the stage volumes drop. You know, her sets were getting out to 2.5 hours. And she just couldn't sing over 100-watt Marshall the whole time. So out of frustration, we made our first amp, which was the London.
Mm-hmm.
And we never really intended on going into business. I just made one for Peter, and he took it to rehearsal, and Sheryl loved it and said, I want one of those. And next thing you know, they go out on tour with our amps, and I'm getting called. I had a real job, like short hair and Dockers and headset and all that stuff. And I'm getting calls from all of my idols going, hey, I just saw Sheryl Crow show, and I talked to Peter, and he said you'd make me one of those amps. I'm like, oh, really? And so they were out for about 8 weeks, and I had 25 orders.
Wow.
And it just kind of has been dragging us down the track ever since. That was about 10 years ago.
So what were the problems you were trying to solve by creating an amp for him?
Well, you know, Sheryl is very particular about sound. She wants vintage sounding mm-hmm. tones, like kind of old school rock and roll stuff, not modern rock sounds. And, you know, Peter was on tour. He had a 100 watt Plexi and a Blackface Super and a couple of other vintage amps. And she wanted those quality of sounds only at low volumes. And it was pretty hard to find. And so at the time, I had a 63 AC-15 twin that he really loved. And he had one of the original Marshall 18 watts. And that thing was kind of catching on then. And we tried every boutique amp that we could find. And none of them were kind of robust enough to do her gig. Because at that point, you know, he had to do 10 years of her catalog. Now it's 20 years.
Right.
So out of frustration, he said, I wish we had an amp that had your AC-15 and my Marshall 18 watt in one box. And I'm looking at the schematics going, you know, they have a lot in common. We could do that. And so we made the first amp, and we changed the circuits and, you know, sort of enhanced them and did some changes, but they're based on those two amps. And the guys over at Mercury Magnetics here in Chatsworth helped us come up with a transformer set that would blend those two preamps together. And so basically she wanted real sound at a volume she could sing over.
Well, I know you're really into transformers, and we'll get into that later in the show.
I am a transformer nerd.
Yes. Now, what were the issues you had with a lower volume amp trying to reproduce the higher volumes? Like, what did you have to
There's a couple characteristics that low volume amps or low powered amps have. When you push them really hard, they get a thing called crossover distortion, which is that buzzy, rippy sound you've experienced. So, like, mm-hmm. you crank up a little amp, they kind of just go. And so we found sort of a hi-fi trick to get rid of that. And then we changed the filtering and the AC handling of the amp so that it acted snappier and bigger. But then also just that it was touch sensitive all the way around the range. So little amps are great, but they're not as dynamic as a big amp. And so there was a lot of sort of nudging we had to do to make a little amp be touch sensitive and responsive. And then it sounds like a big amp when you put a good mic in front of it.
Well, that's important. I mean,
yeah.
It's, you know, it's kind of the way things are kind of going now. I mean,
right.
People are using the smaller amps. They're not using the big stacks, and half the time those big stacks aren't even turned on.
That's right. Well, we got to be honest too. I hate to admit this, but rock and roll's not a young man's game anymore.
that's true.
You know, I loved my 100 watt Marshall when I was in my early 20s, and I can't stand it now. I mean, I can play it for 5 minutes once a month and go, oh yeah, that's great. Okay, I'm gonna get sick. And but especially, you know, when shows are 2 and 3 hours and you got an artist that's 40, 50, 60 years old, they don't want to scream at the top. They can't hit those high notes anymore.
No.
And it's hard over a loud amp. It's fatiguing. Yeah.
Speaking of lower volume, there's one thing that I saw on the website reading on your amps called the reductive master,
yes.
which allows you to get that blown out sound that we like cranked at a lower volume. Can
right.
you talk about that for a minute?
Yeah, the reductive master, actually, we kind of quit doing that.
but it
was our first step towards what we have now, the master voltage. Are you guys familiar with the Fletcher-Munson curve? Have you ever heard of that?
I've heard of it, but I don't know that much about
basically,
it.
Basically, scientists measured what your brain does to sound at different decibel levels. And above about 85 decibels, your brain starts to compress, like an LA2A. You know, it mm-hmm. starts rolling off highs and rolling off bass, and then the transients get knocked off, so it sounds a little whoop, you know, you get this swell. And so what we tried to do with that reductive master was emulate the Fletcher-Munson curve. If you've ever been in the room with a 100-watt Plexi, it sounds very different than what you hear when you mic it up.
Yeah.
Because your brain is protecting you. You know, those loud sounds, your brain is going, oh, too much, let's shut it off for a millisecond. And these two scientists, Fletcher and Munson, quantified that, how that works. So we tried to make that happen. We did a pretty good job, but it was ultimately a master volume, so you lost your clean sound. And so the next step after that was what we do now, which is the master voltage, where I'm regulating the voltage on the amp but then I'm also letting the current fluctuate naturally. Whereas, you know, doing like power scaling doesn't do that. It just kind of starves the whole amp. Whereas this one, we take the current down and the voltage goes up. So the tubes act perfectly normal. So it still sounds like a big amp, only we've capped it. Like this amp that I have here, where I have the master voltage setting, I'm running about 7 watts. And it's still, you heard me playing it before, it still acts and sounds like a big amp.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and he has that. We'll hear him play that. And now inside that amp, you have a Celestion Gold and you have a Celestion D12.
Yes.
Heritage, right?
Or no, it's a G12 H30, the anniversary model.
Okay.
Yeah.
So you use Celestion speakers quite a bit.
Exclusively, yeah.
Can you tell us what about them that you like and how they work with your amps?
Well, there's several reasons I like Celestion. You know, you can ask most guitar players and they're, you know, are you a British guy or an American guy? You know, you're a Fender guy, you're a Marshall guy, or a Vox guy. And I'm decidedly a British guy. And that's the sound of British amps. You know, that's every Vox and every Marshall, that's their sound. But also with modern production, they're by far the most consistent and high quality speakers. And I can count on those guys. They're just a fantastic company to work with. But that's the sound I want. You know, that's what Hendrix played through. That's what Jimmy Page played through. All those guys, it's all Celestians. And the other companies that were around, I'm going to do this without saying names. The other companies that were around in the 50s and 60s that still make speakers, their speakers don't sound like the older versions of them.
Right.
Whereas the Celestians are like, they're right there. They sound and act exactly the same. And they're wonderful. But it's kind of subjective. It's like food, you know?
Yeah, absolutely. Have you checked out the new Creamback H?
I do. We have engineering samples of the Creamback M and H, and I like them both. I like them both quite a bit. And I have a cabinet loaded up in the shop right now with two of the H's in there, and I like it a lot.
Well, we have Rick Skillman on the phone. Are you with us, Rick?
Rick? I am here.
Hey, Rick.
Hey, Rick. So this is Rick Skillman from Celestion. He was a guest on our show back in April.
Hey, Rick.
Can you
hear? What's happening, gentlemen?
What's going on? So he's actually traveling out down south right now, so it's very nice of him to be on the phone with us because he's probably on East Coast time right now. But
I'm somewhere in the middle. I'm in the depths of Mississippi looking at a glorious thunder lightning storm here.
Ah, you need to write a blues song then.
Yes. How I miss those.
I did. What? I did when I booked my flight.
So Rick, so we were talking about the Creamback H. Can you tell us about that speaker and then what Celestion was trying to accomplish with that speaker?
Sure. So yeah, we came back first with the Creamback M and then onto the H. The H essentially. So we took a platform of a G12H30. And but the requirement was that a lot of guys are gigging with 112, 212 cabinets, but they'd like to have the push and the air of their conventional 412 cabs. And they still seem to like, you know, I'd say most guys gig in that 15 to 30 watt world. But there's, you know, still plenty of guys that are putting their old, you know, higher powered heads on a smaller cabinet. So it just basically was to give you all that thump and goodness that you're used to with more cabinet behind you, yet in a compact, you know, where you can do it with a 112 or a 212.
Now, is this speaker the one that's kind of closer to what Hendrix would be using, since it's more of a 60s Celestion?
Yeah, so all the recipe is consistent with, yeah, traditional G12H30. This is a 75 hertz cone, so I think Hendrix was most known for the 55 hertz, though he had both, to be honest with you. So yeah, they're both the M and the H Creambacker. It's a 75 hertz cone. And then the difference between an M and a H in any application, whether it's a conventional or a Creamback, is basically magnet. So once we got the M Creamback together, the H followed as a much easier target, if you will. And so far, people are really, really digging them.
Cool.
And, we also had to think about it, and we wanted to make sure that we built something. You know, these are built in the UK, but their price point is something, you know, just a little bit more than like a vintage 30. So it's not as expensive as the Heritage, which is all, you know, built to the 60 spec. But because it's a newer product, we wanted to make sure it was something people, you know, working musicians could get their hands on and use.
Excellent. Well, thank you so much, Rick, for taking the time to speak with us while you're out traveling. Appreciate
it. Yeah, guys, no problem. And always good to hear from you.
All righty. Well, you have any parting words for Dan, you know, that you want to give him that might be fun?
Yeah.
Miss you, Rick.
Yeah, miss you. We talk dogs and horses all the time on the side. Dan's actually a personal friend, and he is the tone man. He knows the business and knows how to make you players sound the best that you can be. So,
oh, you're nice, man.
Listen to Dan. That's your good advice for the day from Rick. So.
Oh, man. Travel safe, brother.
Thanks a lot, Rick.
You guys got it. Cheer you. Bye.
All right, bye.
Bye.
Well,
I paid him for that.
Yeah.
I texted him $20 for nice words on the show.
There you go. Well, let's hear the producer. So you have the producer amp with you.
This is the producer EL. This is the first of the producer series that we did.
And this is 28 watts.
28 watts. The premise on the producer is that we were noticing at the shop, I'm sort of a nerd. I work with a guy named Miles Rose, if you mm-hmm. know Miles. He's sort of the West Coast tube guru. And we started keeping sort of a statistical analysis on the tubes that were coming through the shop because I was losing so much money and on tubes. And when you start grading every tube that comes through the shop, and after a couple of years, we started noticing this curve of just getting little worse every year. And it occurred to me after about 5 years of this that there's going to be a point in the not so distant future where modern tubes aren't going to work with vintage amps. You're going to have to really, really scour modern tubes. Like if you have a 100 watt plexi where the B plus voltage on it can go as high as 550 volts. Right now there's no modern tubes that can take that voltage. And so if you got something under 500, you're okay.
Why is that?
Well, all modern tubes are made on machinery that's at least 40 years old.
Okay.
And it's not state-of-the-art stuff anymore. So the factories that are doing it are usually doing it with machinery they bought from another factory that went out of business. And it's sort of a secondhand notion. But no matter what you do with, I don't know if you've ever seen videos of tube factories. I mean, it looks like something from Willy Wonka's Chocolate Factory. I mean, this mm-hmm. is old technology. And so that machinery just doesn't work as well as it should. And the tolerances aren't there. And then, you know, there's three keys to a good tube. You know, the first of which is the cathode coating has to be perfect on the negative side of the tube. And it's the cathodes that are on modern tubes are pretty dirty. So they don't work consistently. And then the grid windings inside the tube have to be perfectly spaced. And this machinery is just old. It can't do it perfectly anymore. And third is you have to pump a good vacuum. And modern tubes have half the vacuum of vintage tubes.
Really?
Yeah, so you combine that, they just wear out quickly. And they can't take voltage. You know, general rule of thumb, tubes love voltage. I mean, tubes hate voltage, love current. You know, current's the amount of electricity coming into the tube, and voltage is the pressure that it's under. And so modern tubes can't take voltage at all. So just about 3 years ago, 4 years ago, just sitting around with Miles looking at an Excel spreadsheet, went, man, this stuff isn't going to work in 5 or 8 years. I mean, everyone's going to have to redesign their amps. And so going by that axiom of how tubes hate voltage and love current, I started calling the guys over at Mercury and saying, well, can you guys get me a power transformer? You know, if you do the math that delivers all this current but just a little bit of voltage, they went, no one makes anything. I'm like, okay, well, can you make it for me? And the guys at Mercury can't help me design amps, but they can tell me when I'm wrong and they can tell me when I'm right, because they have other customers. So if they help me, it's not fair. So I, you know, after a few exchanges of emails, I got a response. You might be onto something here. We'll wind that up for you. And so this particular amp is a pair of EL34s. It's only 28 watts, but it draws more current than an SVT does.
Oh, wow.
You know, it's still not a ton of current, but It's not like a blow dryer or something, you know, but it, you know, a normal amp of this size, a 28 watt amp would draw like 0.8 amps, you know, something like this. This is drawing 3 amps. But the voltage on it's only 290 volts. So it's 200 volts less than most EL34 amps. So now I'm flooding these tubes with rich AC, and it's not under a lot of pressure. So the tubes are thrilled. They'll do anything you ask. But I had, if I could show you the power transformer, and there's as big as my head, and I know we're on the radio, I have a big head. it's a big transformer, and it's expensive to make. But the tubes are just thrilled. I mean, that amp's been on now for 25 minutes. You can put your hand over there. It's not hot. So at this rate, the tubes will last for decades. But the big surprise was, this is an EL34 amp. You expect really good distortion out of EL34 amps, but you don't expect a great clean sound. And with all this AC going in, there's bathing in AC, the clean sound's really good. And so it really wide, throws a wide net. I can get really good, almost American kind of clean sounds, but then get your classic EL34 right. Raunch and roll that you expect.
Now, are you able to, since you're having those transformers made,
mm-hmm.
is the consistency and the quality control high? Are you able to keep it?
Yeah. Well, they're mercury magnetics, which for those of you that don't know transformers, mercury magnetics here in Chatsworth. And the guys that run the place are both astonishing engineers, but unlike any other transformer company that I've worked with, they're guitar players.
Oh, okay.
And they're like hi-fi nerds. And Sergio Hamernick, who's one of the owners over there, you know, is actually like second engineer on a bunch of Bowie records in the 70s. Like, these guys know tone. And they collect old amps and tubes. So their standards are ridiculously high. You have to pay for it. They're very expensive transformers. But I've been buying my transformers from them for a decade, and I've had problems with one transformer.
That's pretty amazing.
Yeah, it's astonishing. You know, so every amp, there's two or three transformers. Some that have a choke, there's three. And so, you know, that's the equivalent of I've bought, you know, I don't know, 12,000 transformers from them.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Well, I actually did the Fender Champ mercury magnets upgrade.
Oh, yeah.
Which is kind of funny, speaking of, you know, I mean, they're not cheap. I mean, but it the change in that amp after I did it is amazing. But, you know, to purchase that kit without even doing the work.
It's more than the Champ.
Yeah, it's more than the Champ.
Yeah.
And that's and I have to do the work. So.
Oh, yeah.
If you want somebody to do the work for you, you're talking $500 upgrade.
Oh, easy. Yeah, and that's for a little tiny amp.
Yeah.
The transformer set that's in here retail would be close to $1,000.
Wow.
Yeah. I mean, we buy in bulk, so I don't pay anywhere near that. But it's, you know, you're listening to an output transformer.
Right.
Every, you know, that's what's transforming the signal into something that a speaker can use. And then the entire amp is breathing and functioning off of the power transformer. So
yeah.
You can't really afford to skimp in either of those areas without it really being apparent.
Well, we were talking before the show. I mean, even with pre-CBS Fenders,
yeah.
or there's a difference. I've heard good ones. I've heard bad ones.
Yes.
And those transformers are just not consistent.
Right.
But let me ask you, too, because we've heard this from the pedal manufacturers that we've had on the show,
mm-hmm.
is the complaint about consistent parts. Now, you're making your own you're having your own transformers made, so
right.
you got that nailed.
Yes.
But what about the resistors and all? Because you hand wire. How do you keep the? Are you finding it a problem to get, you know, those parts?
Well, the board parts I'm okay with, because we use pretty high end board parts. Like, our resistors are all Vishay Dales, which is a German company, but I think a lot of the resistors are made in Mexico.
Mm-hmm.
If you get the Asian ones, the consistency is a big problem. Our capacitors that we use, our coupling caps, are made by a company called Sozo. They're based out of Florida, but the caps are made in New England.
Mm-hmm.
And they're rigorously tested. And if I could open this up, I could show you. Technically, coupling caps don't have polarity, but we have them mark the easy side of the capacitor.
Right.
So the guitar signal is always going into the soft side of the capacitor. So I don't have a trouble there. The biggest trouble that I have is tubes. They're horribly inconsistent. And I know pedal guys have the same trouble with transistors. Wildly ranging. You know, we make one little pedal that's a treble booster. You know, I used to have a Range Master, so it's kind of a copy of that.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, I have to throw away 75% of the transistors I get.
Wow.
I mean, they're just wildly ranging. Oh, this one gain is 75. This one's gain is 1,500. You know, like... they're just insane.
Yeah.
Tubes are the bane of my existence. And one of the reasons I don't do reverb is reverb pans are the same way. They're just horrible.
Oh, really?
Just horrible.
Okay.
Yeah. So, but I know you guys wanted to hear this.
Yeah, if you wouldn't mind, give us a sample.
Well, so right now, I know on radio, it's hard to see. This is a two-channel amp, and there's kind of an American side, and there's a British side. So right now, I'm on the American side, and you can hear. Expect that out of EL34s. And then I can boost it a little bit. Now, we've got the voltage way down on this amp, so I'm running like 7 watts. But you can push it into a sort of heated up American sound, you know, where you get the... Can I play copyrighted material on your show?
That's fine. Sure, go ahead. That's fine. The reason he's coming in and out is I'm trying to mute when he plays because we're cranking it up a little bit and it'll distort his voice. Sorry about that.
No worries. So that's a big surprise. And if I go over here onto the British channel, again, I've got the master voltage on this on 2.5, so this amp's just barely on, you know. So you hear the big mid-rangey rhythm sound kind of come in. Classic EL34 distortion. So, you know, at 7 watts, that sounds pretty believable. If we could turn it up to
That's pretty amazing at 7 watts. But let me ask you something. You were talking about how clean the ELs. Can you?
Let me go down to the coolest side here, and I can get just straight up, you know. Now, I have like an 80 watt cabinet here that we're pushing with 7 watts, so it's a little dark. Let me see if I can just brighten it really quick.
While he's doing that, I just want to tell you that he is playing a Gibson Les Paul. It's an R8, so it's a 58 reissue. Yeah.
Check our Facebook page. I took a picture of it and his amp, so you can see what we're looking at here.
So I just boosted the treble a little bit, you know, since we're down so low. But, you know, for me, the test of a clean amp with a Les Paul is the middle position.
Okay.
You get that bubbly, sparkly thing. Freddie King, right? Yeah. Mm-hmm. Now, the volume on this channel is over 6, which would normally be into breakup territory. You know. This Les Paul's pretty dark, too. But. Very American sounds. All the way up to... Sounds like a little American amp.
Yeah.
And then if I just push it a little harder, I think you're good. Does not sound like a British amp. You're getting that squawky, honky thing that you would expect from an American sound. And that's EL34s. Now, the 6L6 version of this does that way better, but the surprise on that is that the distortion's fantastic, and you don't expect good distortion out of 6L6s. Mm-hmm. And that's, again, because the tubes are just flooded with rich AC, and it's not under a lot of pressure.
Well, how would you classify a 6V6, 6L6, EL34? How do you picture them in terms of sound? What would you use what for what?
Well, that's a good question. You know, the traditional use of a 6V6 is sort of, you know, your Fender Deluxe, 6L6, Twins, Supers, Showmans, sort of a nice, round, clean sound without a lot of mid-range to it. But that's because of the Fender circuit. Mm-hmm. We have an amp called the Empire where I use 6V6s, and it sounds dead nuts like a Marshall.
Because Marshall, their Hayes series are all 6V6.
Yeah, 6V6 is kind of a guppy of tubes. It can do anything. Most people, it's a conversation I have a lot. Like, don't think you know what an amp sounds like because of the power tubes. You know what it sounds like because of the genre they were used in, but they're all really flexible. Like this amp, you know, you heard the very British sounding distortion, but the circuit on the side has nothing to do with a Marshall or a Vox or a Watkins or a Selmer or a Hi-Watt or anything. It's just ours. But I get British behavior out of it. And then with the exact same tubes on the other side, I can get a very American response out of it. And it's not really a Fender circuit. There's elements of Fender. There's elements of Ampeg. There's elements of just 65 in there. So they're pretty flexible. I mean, you know, the 6V6, I mean, for those of you guys that don't know, the tubes that start with numbers, those are the American tubes. And the tubes that start with letters, those are the European tubes. So the two main tubes in America, the 6V6 and the 6L6, there's kind of, the 6L6 is the big brother to the 6V6.
Right.
And then in Europe, there's the EL84, which is like what's in most Vox amps. And then its big brother is the EL34. The EL tubes are much more mid-rangey. They're not as full range as the 6Vs and 6Ls. They tend to break up really nice. Their distortion is very smooth and harmonic and sweet, whereas the 6Vs and the 6Ls tend to break up sort of ratty. Mm-hmm. And they're not. They tend to sound like they're getting ready to blow up a little more.
I was going to say, just out of curiosity, I mean, why are there different tubes for American versus British? I mean, how did that occur?
I think it just developed in sandboxes back then. You know, the beam pentode, which is what all those are, a pentode meaning it has five elements to it, those are mostly developed during World War II. And there was this rapid development during the war because they had a need for these things. And the two big factories of the day were RCA here in the United States and then Mullard in Britain. And they're really similar, but for whatever reason, their respective engineers said, no, I don't want to do it that way. I want to do it this way. It's just kind of like we drive on the right side of the road and they drive on the left. There's no rationale for it. They just preferred it that way. But the purpose for tubes was a little different here than it was in Europe as well. And also, you know, they're running 50 hertz power at 220 volts, so they probably noticed different performance. You know, like our amps, my British bass amps sound better in Europe than they sound here.
Really? Now, you have a variable. Can you change the voltage?
As far as the government knows, no.
Oh, okay.
Now, we make different models for export than we do for the U.S.
Okay.
When we first started, I had an adjustable voltage selector, but that's highly illegal. And I was only selling to touring artists. Anyway.
But how does Marshall do that?
You can do it, but you have to put all the safety net and this massive array of fuses behind it.
Oh, okay.
Which isn't realistic for a hand-wired amp. I would hand-wiring that stuff would be, you know, it would make the amp 30% larger just for the protection circuits to do that.
Now, this amp is then basically, the concept of it is basically to give you the Marshall and the American Fender type sound which makes it a nice little studio package.
Yeah, and then I call it the producer as kind of an entendre. You know, I sell these two producers like twice a week. I sold one to Randy Jackson today.
Oh, okay.
And sold one to Brett Chasen last week. I mean, producers eat it up. But it's sort of the old joke, like, you know, the sales guy that sells the most, he's the producer. You know, he can make stuff happen. And that was just a joke name for this amp, and we stuck with it. It's like, it'll just kind of do whatever you want. And so you got four distinct voices here. And if you're going out on a gig, like I'm particularly not a pedal guy. I have a hard time remembering, I have to turn off my Univibe, you know, because it's the verse now. But just with a little simple foot switch, I've got enough vocabulary that I can do a gig without carrying a bunch of stuff around, without having a pedal board.
Now, what does the foot switch do? I can't see it from
here. Oh, it's a dual button foot switch. So each channel, can you see the lights changing over there? Each channel has a dual color LED that switches from green to red. So with green, the bump is off. We have this bump circuit where you're kind of bypassing the tone stack a little bit. So when it goes to red, I'm kicking in the bump. And then the other time, I can switch it over to the other channel, and then I can toggle the bump from here as well. Now, there's also switches on the amp. You can do all this manually. Those little toggle switches, I'm presetting where I want the bump to be.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, if I want to go from voice 1 to voice 3 and then to voice 4, then I can preset it there and then just slide through it. Or I want it to go 1 to 2 to 4 and skip voice 3. You can preset it with those toggles. So, and you can still change it no matter where you are, but you can see how the bump switch on this side is to the right, so it's defaulting to the bump off with the green light. And then over there you can see that it's the switch is to the left, it's defaulting to the bump on. So if I just toggle between those two channels, I've got the hot American sound and the cooler British sound on tap.
Right.
Now, now when designing an amp like this, how long does it take for you to, from start to finish, to create this?
Oh, it kind of depends on the amp. My normal process is about 18 months. Just because I'm really neurotic. I don't know if you guys talk to anybody that's worked with us, but I'm so terrified that I'm going to rush something out and it'll go wrong in public. It's really fear-based. So it goes back to Peter. You know, Peter plays with Cheryl. Peter's my best friend. He's godfather to my children. He's best man at my wedding. And I know Cheryl from the University of Missouri. We went to school together. And so I know Cheryl's a very demanding boss. So we made this first amp for Peter, and I was terrified. Oh, my God, Cheryl's going to fire Peter if something goes wrong. So we just overbuilt the daylights out of it. I made so many choices inside the chassis to keep it just absolutely bulletproof. It's all mil-spec stuff, and it's crazy. The chassis is made out of 0.09 aircraft aluminum. You know, the whole thing, extra levels of fusing to keep it safe because I was absolutely terrified it was going to fail on stage and Cheryl was going to fire Peter. And so we just keep building them that way. So I tend to just test and retest. And the guys in my shop just, I drive them crazy. Come on, Dan, it's good enough. You know it's right. They just think I'm a neurotic freak. Usually, most times, 6 months later, they'll look back and go, I hear what you were hearing now. Half the time, they just go, man, Dan's a nut job. But truth be told, I love that process. I really enjoy it. Each one of these amps is sort of like my children. Mm-hmm. And I have a special relationship with each one. And there's a clear, distinct thing that I hear in my head. And I'll just chase it until I find it. And some amps have, you know, this one took about a year and a half. The Empire, which is the one Peter and I really worked on together, which is the three Marshall voices in one box, that one took like 4 years. And it's got this really complex switching system in it that's hard to do hand-wired.
The Empire was the one that you originally made for his...
No, that was the London. Yeah, the London, okay. Yeah. The Empire is one that's... it's, you know, we got like a JTM-45, a Plexi, and a hot-rodded Mark II Marshall all in one box. And it was really hard to make all that live in the same box together. But Peter and I are both such British amp nerds that we have this way of communicating. You know, there's no adjectives to describe it correctly, but we're almost there. You know, it needs a little more of the, oh, yeah, I know exactly what you're talking about. And so that one took us like 4 years. They're just working on the side, like, hey, let's put some more time. I'll send the chassis to Peter in Atlanta. Oh, yeah, check out Channel 2. I did this. All right, okay. Yeah, you're getting there. That's it. And we have a lot of reference amps. You know, we have a large collection of vintage amps between us. And so we can just sit there side by side. And every artist that came through, I'd go, would you listen to my 50-watt Marshall and then play this prototype? Oh, yeah, that one doesn't do the thing. And everybody plays differently. And so we're – anyway, long answer to a short question. Sorry.
No, it's interesting.
You're getting a sense of my neurosis here. it's really, really fun. And you can't see it on the radio, but even talking about it, I get excited. It's really
– well, hearing you play it, the thing I noticed about the amp is your sound is – you got control over it. It's there, and when you say, okay, here, check this sound, it's right there on the money, and it's you know.
Yeah.
I mean, I have a bunch of vintage amps myself, and you got to tweak them. Right. You got to sit there and mess with them.
And that's no fun when you're on stage. I mean, I was playing for a living for over 12 years, and there's nothing worse than having a gig where you're constantly back here twisting knobs and hoping that the singer waits for you to start the song.
Yeah.
And everyone in the band's going, dude, come on, quit playing with your amp. Just make it sound good. So, okay.
Now you were talking about tubes. I want to ask you because you've played around with some other tubes that are not common.
Yeah.
And one of them that you mention on your website is which is, by the way, www.65amps.com. But you mentioned the EF-86.
Yeah.
Tell me about that.
The EF-86 is a tiny, tiny Pinto. It looks like a 12AX7, but inside it has five elements. Whereas 12AX7 has two tubes, two actual circuits in it that are three parts. That's why it's called a twin triode. Mm-hmm. The EF86 is a tiny little pentode, so it has a control grid like a 12AX7 does, but then it also has a screen grid and a suppressor grid like a Beam pentode does. So they were originally used for little tiny power amps. They were used in a lot of German microphones as well, like a lot of really old Neumanns have EF86s in. And they're also used for headphone amplifiers. They put two of them in a push-pull pair just to run headphones. And then the guys at Vox in the 50s were making amplifiers for organs. And they realized it was a really cool little tube to put in the preamp section because it would get this nice little rich distortion. So it would make an organ sound very textured. And then they naturally put it in some of the earliest Vox amps. And it's a really sweet distortion. It's a really, really particular tube, though. It's noisy. There's no such thing as a quiet EF86. You can always tap on it and and hear noise. But the word bad analogy that I always make is it's sort of like dating the best-looking girl in school. She's in a bad mood half the time. She's kind of expensive, but she's sure fun to kiss.
Right. You know?
And that's the way the EF86 is. It's just such a brilliant, glorious sounding tube. You put up with a little noise. It's a very specific sound. This particular amp doesn't have one in it, but we have several that do, like the London and the Soho and the Ventura. And it's just a very distinct sound that's very rich and it's very lush in the mid-range. It sounds like you're stacking two guitar tracks when you play it.
You're speaking about organ, using as an organ. Have you ever analyzed a Leslie? Because those that tube distortion from a Leslie cabinet was to die for.
Oh, it's really good. There's a couple of amp makers that their amps are actually based on Leslie amps. Richard Goodsell out of Atlanta, a lot of his amps, and Dr. Z, Mike Zate in Cleveland. They have a couple amps that are literally the old...
Did they use that tube, or did they...
They converted it to 12AX7s.
Oh, okay.
But a lot of the Leslies, too, had 12AX7s in them. But it's a certain style of circuit and certain style of transformer. And it's a cool sound. I know exactly what you're talking about. I actually just sold my last Leslie cabinet. I had a little 112 Leslie cabinet.
Oh, wow.
Great thing. And I sold it to a guy over at Fox at their studios. They do television work over there, and they use it all the time. Great sound. If you like the sound on Abbey Road of, you know, While My Guitar Gently Weeps and all that kind of stuff, that's the one. That's a Leslie cabinet, yeah.
Yeah, it had the distortion was one of the best. It just works.
Yeah.
Both for organ, I mean, obviously guitar, but I mean, even when you hear that organ cranked up through like Keith Emerson's, it's just killer.
Yeah, who's the guy? I'm blanking on his name now. Deep Purple.
John Lord.
John Lord. When they first started, he was using Leslie's before he just started pumping the Hammond into Marshall's.
Yeah, I saw him with the Marshall.
Yeah. Wonderful sound.
Now, you make some amps with vibrato and like the little Elvis.
Yeah, the tremolo. Yeah.
Tremolo. Do you use the whole entire tube when you do that, or do you use half a tube? How do you?
I use one triode. The way ours work, it's not a Fender style tremolo. You know, the Fender style tremolo has a little oscillator in there, so it's basically interrupting the signal. Like if I was going like this in front of your face. We use one, it's a bias tremolo. So what the effect is if someone's standing there with a volume knob going turning it up and down really fast.
Right.
So we make the oscillation out of a circuit instead of an opto switch that just interrupts it. So it's a different sound. It's really swampy. It's really organic. But the cool thing about the bias tremolo is you don't lose your pick attack. Because, you know, on certain tremolos, if you happen to hit the pick at the second that the tremolo is off, you don't hear it. It's just not there. So this one, you can kind of overdrive the tremolo and play through it, and then the ring starts to come up in tremolo. It's really fun. It's kind of limited, and it's a very vintage sound. I just happen to really like it. But we use one half of a triode to do that.
Excellent.
Yeah.
Now, can you talk about your QC process? So it was one thing I was watching your video tour, and then it kind of led me to another video where I watched your engineer actually go through and test an amp.
Yeah, this is another place where I'm just terrified. Things are going to go wrong. Our big joke at the shop is I never want to see these amps again unless they're on TV. I hate fixing amps. There's nothing more boring and tedious than fixing amps. To me, that is. Some people really enjoy it, but I despise it. So we have two techs. So I have a master builder, like I said, who's military trained. 99 out of 100 amps he hands to my head tech. They fire right up and everything's okay. But I have him tech it. We go through this really specific long list of tests. We do voltage places and, you know, just make sure everything's okay. I can actually measure the ground hum on an oscilloscope and make sure it doesn't go over, you know, a certain decibel rating and all these things. And then we put it on a burn rack. I downloaded this program from NASA like 10 years ago. It's still up there if you go to NASA's website. It's what they use to stress out their electronic equipment. So I have a computer with a little rack mount, 8-channel mixer. We run that into the open chassis during the day. At night, we hook cabinets in there to break in the cabinets. And it just beats the tar out of the amp. It gives it way more abuse than a guitar and pedal board could ever do. And so if it survives the rack, which they almost all do unless there's a tube failure, if it survives the rack, then it goes to a completely different tech. I want a completely different set of eyes on it. Because, you know, it's normal human complacency to go, I've done this, it's fine. I want another guy to look at it cold, and that's our second tech, a guy named Joe Bourdais, and he will go through it again, same set of tests. If it clears that, then it goes into a cabinet, and then we'll have it play tested again, and usually we try to have two people play test them, and there's a specific set of tests for microphonics on the tubes, and the volume and the knobs are all working right. We have a really nice dB meter. Every amp should hit a certain decibel level to show that it's working correctly. And it's about a 2 to 3 day process on each amp once the first guy techs it. And then while it's on the burn rack, the transformers break in and the caps break in and the speakers break in. And everything's, you know, a brand new amp right off the rack is really crispy. And so this way it kind of feels like an old friend. Mm-hmm. But I sleep well at night knowing that when it goes out the door, that, you know, people pay a lot of money for our amps. They're not cheap. And so I feel I owe it to them to do this.
Mm-hmm. And does your amp still come with the lifetime warranty?
We do. It's a limited lifetime warranty. We don't warrant the tubes and speakers
right.
for a lifetime. The tubes and speakers are carried with the manufacturer. Having said that, Celestion never asked a question. I've probably bought 70, 80 pallets of Celestion speakers so far, and I think I've had two that had a problem.
So let me ask you this question. So I know that you go through some pretty, you know, crazy sorting out tubes. I mean, you said that you keep about 40% of your tubes.
I have nightmares about
that.
So
what do you recommend your customers do in the year and a half, 2 years, unless they have the producer amp, which they can have for decades, but let's say they have your other amp and they can replace the tubes in a year. How do they do that?
Well, there's good vendors that we work with. You can always call us and we'll help you. But there's two or three places you can get spec'd and graded tubes. Out here in the West, the only place is Antique Electronics over in Phoenix. There's ARS here in Van Nuys, but I don't think they sell to the public. I think they're all just wholesale. On the East Coast, Doug Preston, DougsTubes.com. These are the guys I know that actually test a tube,
mm-hmm.
not just measure transconductance on it. Transconductance is one of five measures that you need to do to see if a tube's working properly. Transconductance just measures how much electricity comes out one side of the tube versus what came in. It doesn't tell you how it rises and, you know, if it interacts, all that stuff.
You say that on your website that you don't have the problems that a lot of us have where you have to bias a lot or consistently in the tube wear. Is that because of how you do the voltage compared to the current, or is that because of the transformer?
Well, it's actually something else. That's a good question. I like the sound of cathode bias. And a cathode-biased amp is a self-biasing amp. So the way we're biasing the tubes off the cathodes of the power tubes. Mm-hmm. So when one gets a little weaker, then the current will naturally shift. You know, it's sort of, the bias is like I have two daughters and I have to stay unbiased, right?
Yeah.
I can't love one daughter more than the other. And depending on if one daughter's behaving poorly one day, sometimes that takes a little bit of effort. And same thing with the tube. So the cathode bias circuit will do that automatically to a certain degree. Whereas a grid bias, which is what the bigger amps like Marshalls and things, you have to actually set the bias current yourself. And then when the tubes start to drift, that bias point isn't the same. I think cathode bias sounds better. I like the way it feels and the way it acts, but it's also really friendly if you're on stage. You can just pop tubes in and you're done.
Now, we're getting close to the end of the show.
Oh,
I wanted
I'm sorry.
To ask. No, it's fine.
I ramble.
It goes so fast.
I ramble.
I wanted to ask you, so you guys use birch and use...
we use Baltic birch.
Baltic birch.
Yeah.
And you guys actually... what's the word I'm looking for here? Finger joint, the cabinets.
Yes.
Can you talk about how important that is? And then do you guys do anything with the cloth in the front? Have you tested different cloths?
Yeah, we use acoustic grill cloth. It's not for decoration. It's actually acoustic grill cloth, which is supposed to not affect frequency response that much. But the wood we use is hugely important. We use grade A Baltic birch. So our birch comes from Russia. Mm-hmm. The reason I like that better than the Asian birch is the Russian birch is old growth, so it's like 10 times harder than the Asian birch. But also old growth wood is much cleaner. It doesn't have knots or voids in it. And then, you know, all the old British amps, like that Holy Grail 69 basket weave Marshall cab, they all have finger joints in them. And if you make those joints correctly, the joint is stronger than the wood itself, because my goal with our cabinets, and I think the goal of these guys back then, was you want them to be rugged, of course, but you want it to resonate in sympathy. So it's like a drum shell, you know, instead of just being a box with speakers in it. You want it to resonate in sympathy with your cabinet. So if you use really high-grade wood, you know, that doesn't have knots or voids and you don't have to use nails, the cabinet starts to become this amplifying device. And it really enhances the sound. And you can hear with a lot of cabinets that are made with secondary wood or they don't have joints, there's just a ton of glue and nails in it, they don't sound good. They sound like they're in the next room relative to a nice, proper cabinet. Even the early Fenders were all finger jointed. The pre-CBS stuff was.
Yeah.
And then CBS went, we don't have to do that silly nonsense. It's just a box with speakers in it. Ha ha.
Well, Dan, since we're getting to the end of the show, you mind if I'd like to put you on the spot?
Sure.
We normally have some music at the end, but would you like to play, like, show us the clean sound again?
Oh, sure.
Play something when we go on the way out.
Sure.
But before we do that, we definitely want to thank our sponsors, Celestion. Thank them for sponsoring the show.
Yes, and also to Dan, the show goes so fast. We have to have you back.
I'd love to. I just live right down here at Laurel Canyon.
Oh, okay. We're definitely going to have you back.
I can be your, like, oh, God, the guy didn't show up. Dan, can you get over here in 5 minutes?
Oh, okay.
Because we haven't even gotten into musician jokes yet. I got to tell you one, though. I mean, I saw on the website that you started out playing accordion. I mean, have you guys told accordion player jokes?
No.
We've told some drummer jokes, but I figure it's going to come back.
I have
to
one
us.
Accordion player joke, and you won't be hurt by it.
Oh, okay.
So accordion player's coming home from the gig. That's not the joke. And he realizes, oh, crud, I have to pay my babysitter. So he pulls over, and he's running over to the ATM machine. And right when he gets to the ATM, he goes, oh, man, I forgot to lock my car. And he got back to his car, and it was too late. Someone had put two more accordions in his car.
Nice. Well, Dan, thank you so much for coming down. We appreciate you coming in and playing for us. Next week we have a roundtable of women in music.
Yes, we have woman, Monique.
Maybe I need to be here for that.
Caravello, that's a guitar tech.
Oh, nice.
And she does some amazing work. And we got four people that are coming in. It's going to be a really good show.
Oh, excellent.
And don't forget Billy Sheehan in 2 weeks. And make sure to go to our website, www.flowguitarenthusiast.com, and register for that Harkey Bass Attack pedal.
Yes. Okay. Thank you, everybody. And Dan, take us out.
Well, since I have my Rolling Stones shirt on, I think I'll just go out with a little...